Welcome to Louisiana Considered. I'm Adam Voss. Just ahead today, an annual scientific expedition into the Gulf that measures the extent of the dead zone has reached its 40th anniversary, just as funding for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that funds that research, is being threatened. We talk with the chief scientist on that Gulf hypoxia cruise. Also, East Baton Rouge Parish voters will be deciding on renewing a set of property taxes next week, including funding that pays for the local library system. The catch, a little bit of that dedicated property tax is being shaved off the top. Some of that tax money that was meant exclusively to the library is being rededicated to the City Parish General Fund. We hear from our local reporter about why the library is okay with that and how it solves a potential budget crisis for the city. But first, some Head Start providers in Louisiana have taken out loans to keep operating as the government shutdown stretches into its second month. Head Start is a federal program that provides child care and early learning for low-income families across the country. Joining me now to discuss the impact is WWNO WRKF education reporter Aubrey Juhas. Hi there, Aubrey.
Hey, Adam. How are you?
We said at the top of the conversation here that some Head Start providers in the state have taken out loans to keep operating. That seems like a big deal, but why just some of them?
Yeah, so local Head Start programs all over the U.S. are funded annually, but on different cycles. The government hasn't been distributing funding for the program and others since the shutdown started. That means some ran out of money on October 1st, others on November 1st, and even more will run out on December 1st if the shutdown lasts that long. Only a handful of programs ran out last month. None of them were in Louisiana, but a much larger number across the country were expecting money this month. 140 programs covering more than 65,000 kids. That's about 10% of Head Start's total enrollment. In Louisiana, two programs ran out of funding, one in the Lafayette area and another in New Orleans. Together, they care for about 1,300 kids enrolled in Head Start.
Okay. So tell me a little bit more about those programs and how they're handling that lapse in funding.
Sure. So both of the impacted programs in Louisiana have managed to keep their doors open for now. Primetime in the Lafayette area and Clover in New Orleans, formerly Kingsley House, both took out loans to cover their expenses this month. Primetime's parent organization, the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, gave it a loan, and the head of both organizations say they're planning ahead for December if the shutdown continues. Now, Clover took out a line of credit, and a spokesperson told me she couldn't comment at this point on whether they're willing or able to take on more debt if needed. I asked Yolanda Motley, Clover's head of early learning, if they've ever been in this kind of situation.
No. To my recollection, we haven't had to do that before. This is a very different time for all of us.
And Clover, formerly Kingsley House, has been around for more than 120 years.
Do we know if Clover has enough money this month to operate as usual?
So even with a line of credit, Motley told me they've still had to cut spending. They aren't reducing hours or staff, but they've canceled field trips, classroom celebrations, travel for staff, and some professional development. And she's worried about the shutdown stretching into December.
If we do have to shut down, our families won't be able to go to work. So it's going to be a rippling effect.
Motley says children will also miss out on the meals they eat at school, not to mention, you know, this high-quality education that Head Start provides, health screenings, other wraparound services that they provide for parents. While Louisiana's Head Start programs are holding on for now, the National Head Start Association says programs in 15 states and Puerto Rico are closed this week because of the shutdown, impacting more than 8,000 children and their families.
Mm. Aubrey Juhas is WWNO and WRKF's education reporter. Aubrey, thanks for your reporting.
You're welcome.
This is Louisiana Considered. I'm Adam Voss. A trio of property taxes are on the ballot in Baton Rouge next week. They're all renewals, but they've been made a bit more complicated by a series of budget shortfalls, one of the largest reasons for that being the incorporation of breakaway city St. George, a city that now collects its own property taxes. The tax renewal for the local library system has been getting the most attention. The library is fighting to keep its funding, even while the city parish aims to skim a little off the top. To outline what voters have to consider, we have with us Alex Cox, Report for America Corps member, and Baton Rouge reporter for WRKF. Welcome.
Hey, Adam. It's good to be here.
First of all, what got us here? The property tax situation in Baton Rouge has seen some upheaval since the city of St. George was incorporated out of a large chunk of unincorporated East Baton Rouge Parish, hasn't it?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, you know, St. George has to collect its own property tax with the way their government is set up. And then also there is the American Rescue Plan Act or ARPA funding. That's COVID era dollars. Those are starting to dry up and some services were completely funded based off of those ARPA dollars. So City of St. George, ARPA dollars, and then also just prices rising on everything has put the city in kind of a difficult position. So it's looking to make up for about a $21 million budget deficit.
The city is.
The city parish, I should say, yes.
There's an agreement that the city reached with the library and some of the city's departments. What has the library ceded in that? And to what extent does it support the city parish?
So when we're talking about like ceded, very, very tangibly, they've given up a portion of their millage. Essentially, think about a property tax. But they've taken a portion of that millage and rededicated it to the parish generally. And so what the library is essentially now having to do is kind of budgeting around that. So they're looking for places to cut, like they are looking in what they call the databases. So like scholarly databases or, you know, language learning tools. And then they're going to buy a couple less books. And in all of that, I spoke with Mary Stein with the library, and she essentially kind of called this the Thrive Compromise, because listeners might remember that this all began with a much more drastic plan that was not received well at all by the Baton Rouge community.
So this was a compromise, and you called it a rededication, technically. That sounds like something different from just a standard property tax renewal, which is a pretty normal thing to have happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the rededication, what that means is taking money from one pot and moving it to another. So you use the phrase skimming off the top. I think, you know, you can think of that way of a portion of the millage that is already being collected. A big messaging from parish officials is this is not a new tax. Every 10 years, these millages would need to get re-upped anyways, and they would need to re-up at the maximum they would want to collect. So right now, only a portion of each of these millages is being collected. So on paper, your taxes are going to increase a little bit, but that's completely standard procedure. The only thing that really makes this different is, as you said, a portion of this is getting taken off the top and getting moved elsewhere.
What are the sides on this? Who's for the tax rededication, this renewal? Who's against it?
Yeah, so the final version of this plan has kind of unified support from all the parish officials I've spoken to. Really, no one is in opposition of this. I do want to remind everyone that on top of this being a rededication, this is a millage renewal, just as we were talking about. So this is a portion of people's funding that they still have to advocate for. And so really everyone is for this, the library, the Metro Council, the mayor's office, the Council on Aging, and the mosquito abatement. Everyone is for this. And the people who are kind of against this, from what I've read and what I've heard, is essentially they are upset with how this is being done. They would like the library to keep all of their funds, and they don't necessarily like that they're being asked to either fund the library and accept Thrive or not fund the library. So voters don't have the option to vote on Thrive without voting on whether or not the library gets funds. So that's kind of the difficulty on the no option, is usually they are vocal library supporters that want to give more of their tax dollars to the library.
So it sounds like this is quite a compromise. Is that right?
Yeah, I think compromise is exactly the word to use here. All of the three offices negotiated, with kind of the library being the most stark one. That's certainly the news I've been following. But all of them went to the negotiating table, discussed it with people from across the parish, and kind of worked it out to what we have now.
We're speaking with reporter Alex Cox about Baton Rouge's plan to rededicate property tax revenue, a plan that goes before voters next week, November 15th. Now, as you mentioned, this isn't just happening to the library. Tell me about the other two tax rededications Baton Rouge voters will be weighing.
Yeah, so they're also going to look at the Council on Aging's millage and the mosquito abatement's millage, or part of their millage. I say that because the mosquito abatement, this isn't their main millage. This is kind of their rainy day fund, their emergency fund. And this is the case with both the Council on Aging and the mosquito abatement. Neither are collecting their full millages. And right now, the only thing that is being rededicated to the parish generally is what's not being collected. So essentially, the Council on Aging and the mosquito abatement aren't going to be affected at all. They don't take this money normally, so they're not getting money taken from them. Their millages are just going to go back up to the max that they ask for, and the parish is going to take that money.
Hmm. What happens to the library if we vote against this tax?
Yeah, so nothing good, really, because they are without funding. Now, something I haven't really talked about up to this point is that a part of Thrive is also taking money from the mosquito abatement and the library's operating budget. That's somewhere in the ballpark of $58 million for the both of them, $52 million of which is being taken from the library. And now I'm saying it's coming from the operating budget. That's essentially how much money they have to operate. And essentially, they can give up $52 million of those dollars and operate just fine. That is kind of extra. That is kind of used for different projects. You can think of it as a rainy day fund.
For capital expenditure sort of situations.
Yeah, exactly. Mary Stein really hates this word, but I think surplus gives a good idea. Going back to your original question, with that money, they will be able to operate for about a year and a half at current capacity. But, you know, they can't guarantee they will get their millage again. So that's going to look like hours getting cut. That's going to look like staff getting cut. That's going to look like major cuts across the board, much more than what we would see if Thrive does pass. And it's not as simple as just going to the next election, throwing it on the ballot. That is a months long process. The earliest they could get is May if they're lucky. More realistically, November. And even then, that would be a new tax. And everyone knows how Louisiana voters have been reacting to new taxes lately. And then also, they probably wouldn't get the money for this year, just because, again, it's a new tax. And so the library would be put in a really, really difficult spot.
One of the viewpoints on getting this money from the library rededicated when the city parish was first talking about it was that the library was just swimming with funds or something like that, along with other city parish departments. How has the library spoken back about that? What does the picture really look like with both operating funds and then some of the not rainy day funds, what you referred to?
Well, that's the thing is the library is very, very good with its money. So it has been able to have this budget to work on capital projects and things it would like to get done. Like, for example, they were going to look into making a mobile makerspace. Think like 3D printers and everything you expect in like the normal makerspace, but on wheels. That is a very expensive project that probably won't happen now. And so, you know, this money can be taken away.
We've been speaking with Report for America Corps member, our Baton Rouge reporter, Alex Cox. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
From WRKF and WWNO, this is Louisiana Considered. I'm Adam Voss. Every year for the past four decades, a ship has gone out into the Gulf with a crew of scientists on an expedition to measure how much oxygen is in the water. It's the Gulf Hypoxia Cruise, and it's put on by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. It's an integral component in measuring the dead zone to find out how much the lack of oxygen in the water caused by the Mississippi River runoff is affecting marine life. Our guest today, Cassandra Glaspy, is associate professor in LSU's Department of Oceanography and Coastal Sciences and also chief scientist for NOAA's annual hypoxia cruise. She's here as the cruise celebrates its 40th birthday this year. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
So I introduced this a bit, but tell us more about how important this cruise is when it comes to measuring the dead zone in the Gulf and why that dead zone is important to us.
Sure. Well, every year, this generally is a seasonal thing. So every year in the summer, we have this zone off of our coast that doesn't have any oxygen, and that is as bad as it sounds for the fish. We wouldn't be able to survive without any oxygen, and the fish can't either. And so there's a large portion of our water that we like to fish, that we like to boat on, that can't support life. And so the hypoxia cruise is our way to measure that, measure the extent of it, understand how that changes from year to year, how it changes with decisions or with storms. And the annual hypoxia cruise only happens once per year. So we get one shot at seeing what the hypoxia looks like out there. And that's always the last week in July.
And I assume that's scheduled for when the dead zone is at its greatest or worst.
Yeah, historically, when we've been able to look at hypoxia over seasons, over a whole year's worth of variability, that's been the time when the hypoxic zone was the largest. I'm not sure if that's true anymore. I kind of feel like we might be catching it maybe a little bit too soon nowadays, but we haven't done really a year-long study to really say that. We try and catch it when it's at its worst.
So when this cruise got started 40 years ago, who advocated for its scientific necessity? How did we find out we needed to learn about this dead zone?
Yeah, so at that time, there were scientists from LSU and from LUMCON, which is Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, that were out there sampling the waters just offshore, doing a lot of different sampling, not just oxygen, but phytoplankton, nutrients, even sampling the mud at the bottom to figure out what critters were living there. And as they were doing that, they noticed this thing was happening where they were finding these large stretches of water that had no oxygen at the bottom. And that wasn't anything new in terms of around the world. We have a lot of these areas that have low or no oxygen. But that was the first time it had been seen, at least persistently, in Louisiana. And so that was when the hypoxia cruise was really born. I mean, when we find something like that, we have to map its extent. That's our best way to get the information out. And it's continued because the problem has continued.
And tell me about everybody who has a stake in measuring this and finding out more about the dead zone. Is it just people who care about whether there's fish in the water, climate scientists? Tell me more about what we find out.
So there's actually a lot that we don't really know about our coastal waters. We don't have a whole lot of long-term monitoring in Louisiana, even in the Gulf Coast, you know, compared to some other locations like Chesapeake Bay or California that have a lot of annual, also monthly monitoring. We don't really have a lot here in Louisiana. And so our stakeholders are anyone that really cares about what's going on with our coast, which, if I know anything about Louisianans, is just about everybody, because everybody likes shrimp or crawfish, fish or fishing, or they know someone who builds that into their life. And so if we care about these things, we have to better understand what impact we're having on our coast.
We're talking with Cassandra Glaspy of NOAA's annual hypoxia cruise, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. Tell me about the role in the cruise in taking these measurements, because people might be surprised to learn that you don't just have satellites doing this. It sounds like you have to actually touch the water.
We do, yes. Well, this is fortunately for me because I love to get in the water, but a lot of what we're studying on the bottom of the water column can't be sensed, at least not reliably, from the surface. We're really trying to figure out ways that we can do this more remotely, but for now, really the only way we can understand what the oxygen or anything really below the surface looks like is to go out there and actually sample. And the way that oxygen sampling works is we send down, it has to be something heavy, even though the oxygen probe is really tiny and can be sent down just by itself, the currents out there are wild. So we have to send down a big, heavy device. It's basically a cage. We can strap all of our sensors on it. In reality, it's a big cage that has sensors, and one of those is oxygen. We send that down and we're taking a full profile. So from the surface to the bottom, we can see what the oxygen levels are. And then we have fixed stations that we stop at to go ahead and collect those data. Usually we've got crew on board that are collecting physical samples of water as well to validate or to see like what the phytoplankton community is doing, what the bacteria are doing, things that might be of interest to managers.
And tell me about the products that you turn with this data. What does it contribute to the dead zone forecast? What all depends on it?
So the models that make the dead zone forecast every year are built on the data that we collect. And in turn, we use the data that we collect to validate the predictions of the models. So we can have a better understanding if our models are missing something. And also, as we collect more and more data, those models become better and better at their job. And this is really what it takes to build a predictive model. It needs a lot of data, needs a lot of validation.
And the big question, what's the funding situation for this cruise? I understand NOAA is in the target of some potential funding cuts. What does it take to do this? And how are you being affected by the funding situation?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we get a lot of value out of this cruise, and it's not very expensive. So we have to be out there for about a week. But even the big ship that we take out there, it's only about $13,000 or $14,000 a day. So it's not even that expensive when it comes to the grand budget. But it always does seem like the cruise is on the chopping block. So every year we have to, you know, justify the work that we do. And there have been decisions in the past to take away certain data streams, such as collecting data on phytoplankton and collecting data on nutrients. And all of these things are connected together to make the oxygen levels drop. And so getting a full picture of the story really requires all of these data to be collected. And we're at a point now where if we leave one out, we break a long time series that's really valuable for model building. So I feel like it's my job as a scientist to explain to folks who are trying to cut the budget what they stand to lose. It might not be a big deal for them to say, we're not going to assess chlorophyll this year, the phytoplankton, because we don't have enough money. But to me, as I think about building the models, I know that that's kind of a make it or break it situation. We want to have consistent data year after year.
And tell me finally, illustrate, what's it like to be on this cruise? We're calling it a cruise as if it is recreational or idyllic. Tell me what it's like out there.
My husband reminds me after I get back from the cruise and I'm so exhausted that actually I'm working 24-hour shifts. And you know what? He's absolutely right. We work so hard on this cruise. I take out a variety of generally untrained undergraduates. So many of you listeners, these are your kids I take out in the field. And they gain so much work experience, but they work so hard. They're working 12-hour shifts. The samples come fast, every 20 minutes, 40 minutes. And so they're doing analysis in the lab. The lab has no windows. It's on a ship. There's a lot of seasickness. And I'm there to coordinate it all. So we really do have a great crew. It's a great time. They gain a lot from it. There's a lot of bonding. There's really good food, honestly. But it is not like a carnival cruise, that's for sure. It's a lot of work.
And how far does it take you?
So we kind of zigzag offshore, back inshore, offshore again. And we keep up that pattern to visit locations that we visited every year of the cruise. So we can have a really good, consistent area that we know is affected. And we follow the dead zone as far as it goes. So some years it goes past the border into Texas. Some years it goes really far into Texas. Haven't seen that in the last few years. But yeah, we try and go as far offshore as we can find the dead zone and then as far down the coast as we need to.
Do you think you have enough insight to say whether the dead zone is on a shrinking trend?
It's really hard to say from the aerial estimates that we produce every year. And that does seem like it has been high in the last several years, but there's no real trend of increasing when you look at the surface area. However, this is one of the things that we can do with all these data we've collected and that are available to the public is we can now look at them and see what the volumetric measurements are. And I suspect that we have been increasing in volume. The hypoxia really extends the entire shoreline, which is kind of the worst case for the fish because they don't get a break from it. And when it does that, a lot of the water column itself is impacted. So the volume or like the amount of the three-dimensional space that that hypoxia is taking up, I suspect that we're going to find that that's been increasing when we go to take a look.
Cassandra Glaspy is Associate Professor in the LSU's Department of Oceanography and Coastal Sciences and also Chief Scientist for NOAA's annual hypoxia cruise. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
From WRKF and WWNO, that's been Louisiana Considered this Wednesday. I'm Adam Voss. But thanks to our guests today, Aubrey Juhas, Alex Cox, and Cassandra Glaspy. Our managing producer is Alana Schreiber. We receive production and technical support from Garrett Pittman and our assistant producer, Aubrey Purcell. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at 12 noon and 7 p.m. on this station. I'm Adam Voss. Thanks for listening.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from Tulane School of Public Health.